From RTE Radio 1, you're listening to Arena Encore.
To start us tonight, Barbara Taylor Bradford's A Woman of Substance is one of the best-selling novels of all time. It's a story of ambition, survival and revenge. It was first adapted for television back in 1984 to enormous success, and now Channel 4 has made a new adaptation for a new generation. Brenda Blethyn and Jessica Reynolds share the role of Emma across two eras of her extraordinary life. Jessica Reynolds joins me in a few moments, but first here's a scene from the series where younger Emma visits her mother on her sickbed and gives her money she's earned from cleaning and mending. Sophie Bold here, playing Emma's mother.
Something on your mind?
Someone.
Mum. I know those mill boys finish early on a Saturday, but you stay focused, you hear? Did you get your extra dining money?
I have.
Keep climbing, Emma. You're talented, with your dressmaking. You've an eye.
I've got two.
And if you're smart, which I know you are, you can get out to fairly. Don't be like me, you hear? Remember your plan with a capital P. Get out and get on. Or the rest of us, if we're born in fairly, we'll die here. But you won't get trapped. Remember, without money, you're vulnerable. So stay focused. And if a chance comes, you grab it. You hear me?
Jessica Reynolds, you're very welcome to Arena. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This series tells the story of Emma Hart over two very distinct timelines. So you're playing the younger Emma in 1911. She's kind of at the rags end of this rags to riches story. So tell me a little bit about your version of Emma.
Yep, she's in amongst the rags. So we start off, 1911, and she's an impoverished maid working for a very aristocratic family. And she's goes through a lot very quickly, not to give any spoilers, but she goes through something, you know, in the very first episode that teaches her to strive for more than where she came from. And so she spends her life being wronged by people, with really tricky things happening to her, and she learns at a very young age what survival is and how to run away from where she started and create a better life for herself.
Yeah, Fairly Hall, this large country mansion that she's working in, owned by the Fairley family. I mean, it's not an easy life there unless you're one of the family, and even possibly even if you are.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, like, in often we see in really wealthy families, like, there might be material wealth, but there isn't wealth in a sense of community and closeness and an ability to communicate. I think that's often missing in families like that, and it is in this story. And that manifests itself in hostility and you know, strict tradition, I suppose. And Emma feels the wrath of that. And it's very different from her home that she comes from.
She is ambitious, though, and she does want to get out of Yorkshire, and she wants to make something of herself. So she goes about actually doing that as opposed to just wishing for it.
Oh, absolutely. I think this is an interesting thing. I think maybe some people are born with it and some people aren't. Like, I remember we've done a couple of Q&As and stuff on this, and Brenda Blethyn, who plays Emma Hart in the 1970s, she says, you know, I'm different from Emma in that way because I'm devoid of ambition and drive. And I don't know if that's fully true, because, like, look at where she's got to. But she does say that, and she what she means by that is kind of she's satisfied with what she's got. You know, she's, like, grateful, and I think probably didn't expect so much success in her life, and she's kind of content with that. Whereas you get someone like me, who's, like, from such a young age, I've got a kind of ideal and a vision of something else ahead of me. And I've just ran after that from a young age. So I don't know. I also had a mum really like Emma's, that was kind of was from a really poor background, was like, you can do whatever you want to do. So I don't know if it's, you know, funnels down from your parents or whatever, but yeah, she's inspiring in that way.
I want to play a clip from the series itself. There's like a key moment in Emma's youth. It's her relationship with one of the Fairley sons. We find that out early on in the first episode, played by Ewan Horrocks. But as tended to happen in those sorts of locations and those places, it's a forbidden romance. It could have consequences for her. It's not an easy thing for her to be dealing with, is it?
No, not at all. I think like your first love impacts you more than any other relationship really in the world, apart from your parents maybe, but that's where you learn what love is and you kind of act accordingly after that ends, depending on how it ends, depending on what goes on. And often I think we, you know, throw the guards up and it changes us drastically.
Edwin.
Emma.
I thought you didn't graduate till summer.
Any excuse to come home?
Well, you'll have missed your family.
Have you met my family? Father's hosting a weekend of some dignitary or other. I'm supposed to impress them.
Well, good luck. Being impressive.
So what about the patriarch, Adam? He's played by the great Emmett J. Scanlon, who's a fellow Irish actor. So what was it like having to develop a relationship with him on set and realising that the two of you had something that you shared one way or the other in a strange circumstance like that?
Yeah. Well, I'd kind of been aware of Emmett for a while, but we hadn't like fully met. And I don't know. I feel like meeting him and working with him, he's just the funniest person. He doesn't take himself seriously at all. And maybe I was worried that he'd be the sort of person that maybe would. But he's just so laid back. He works really hard. He's so kind to everyone. And he was just like, he just had me laughing. His comedic timing is amazing. I don't know, like he hasn't done like that much comedy stuff, or maybe I'm wrong and he has, but like he just really has this comedic timing that has me in tears. He's got like these wee short videos on his like Twitter and stuff, on his Instagram, and he's brilliant. And he plays a ripe beep in this show, but he plays it with such like strange sensitivity, and you kind of feel sorry for him and hate him at the same time. And you're kind of like, he also doesn't know what he's doing. He has all this wealth and all this material around him, but he doesn't have a clue. And so, you know, he's kind of acting like his father probably acted, and how fathers and fathers behind him and behind his generation acted. And so, yeah, I think he plays it really interestingly.
I think it's a bit of a shame if his comic timing is so amazing, because people will see him in this. They'll have seen him most recently in How to Get to Heaven from Belfast, yeah, in Lisa McGee's series, in which his is a very, very serious character in that as well. So that's not something that comes out necessarily in the roles we see him in at the moment.
I know, and that's why I'm like, everyone's missing a trick, because he's got like Mobland and stuff like that, and he has that kind of look, but he's just got something inside of him that I think plays against his look so well. And yeah, Augie's just great, great crack, a lot of love for Emma.
You, of course, don't appear in the later timeline because you're the same character is being played by yourself and Brenda Blethyn. That's set in New York in the 70s. Brenda plays the older Emma. But can you tell us a little bit about that part of the plot? Because that's where we join the story, and about where she finds herself at that stage of her life.
Yeah, well, in the 1970s, she finds herself as the richest woman in the world, with a clothing empire, with a fashion empire. But she finds herself in hot water because there's been leaks about her, and her business is rapidly declining. And she finds herself with a lot of family strains and betrayal within her family and within her kids and stuff. So that's kind of where we start. And it's a good question for us to ask. You know, she transcends her class and ends up with this empire, but is she really as content?
It almost feels like a mini episode of Succession at the very beginning.
Yeah, there is a bit of that.
This is a story about a woman who refuses to accept limitations that are placed on her by class and by gender. She won't stay in her lane in any way, shape or form. Does that feel like a particularly resonant story in 2026?
Yeah, it absolutely does, I think. The system is built for us women, marginalized people that are not seen as conformative people, to suffer in silence. It's built to exhaust us and keep us quiet. And so I think fighting against the powers that be and trying to get out of that lane is a really tricky thing to do. It's a balance, but it's absolutely vital to humanity and the best of humanity. You know, it's absolutely necessary. We can't just surrender to the way that things are, because it doesn't look like they're working very well, does it?
So when, as an actor, a role like this comes along for you that allows you to play somebody like this, is this the sort of thing that immediately just lights up your head and you think, I have to have this?
Yeah, I think, of course, when there's like female-led stories being made by women, like that just is so progressive in itself. And I think it's tricky because, like, with the period drama and with this type, when it first came through, I was really resistant to it because I just didn't see myself being able to play, or it's maybe being accepted as playing like an English Rose, because of what I've done so far, you know, like quite characterful, very Irish stuff. Maybe at first I was kind of defensive and resistant to it, but then when I actually read the episodes and I was like, oh, there's actually something about this, and there's something that I can bring to this, you know, and take something that is more mainstream and maybe put a little bit of something different into it, I suppose. That's what really pulled me.
Does that feel like an achievement as an actor when you look at something initially and think, this might not be for me, but then you go through the process and realise, actually, no, this is very much for me. I just didn't know this was for me.
Yeah, and I think like 9 times out of 10, something will come through. And because we get so many no's as actors, like it is constant rejection, as everyone knows, but you do really feel that. And so you kind of build up narratives in your mind of, okay, I might get far in this part because people will accept me and see me for that, but I won't for that. I don't have a chance. There'll be 100 other actual English girls that will do that far better than me, you know? And so I think it's when someone takes that chance on you and goes, oh, no, we think you can do that. That's like a real heartwarming, beautiful thing when someone sees something in you that maybe you didn't yourself. It's, I have a lot of respect for people that maybe go for like riskier casting options. And
was there any point at which yourself and Brenda Blethyn got to compare notes, or was that something that happened long after the process happened?
Well, Brenda says that she like looked back on footage, I think, of me in terms of like mannerisms and stuff. Obviously, it didn't really make sense for me to look at her. But the time that me and Brenda spent together isn't really been like talking about the show and watching the show. It's just been like connecting and getting to know each other through press and stuff. And she's just class. Like, I can't believe she's 80. And I know everyone says that. We were on the One Show the other day and everyone was just like, she's so vivacious and she's so witty and funny. And like, she's fully herself and she doesn't let anyone stop her from being that. And that's like, that's so admirable. Like, I want to be like that when I'm 80, you know?
Did you have any sense of the story before you came to it, either through the book or through the TV series that was made in 1984?
I actually didn't. It was all such a whirlwind. Like, it came in and then it was the tape and then the recall, and then within 3 weeks I was filming. So it was like so quick, and I think maybe my mum was like, oh, maybe I've heard of that kind of thing. But I was pretty unaware.
Before I let you go, I do want to ask about something else. You've been cast in another Channel 4 series, It's Close to Home, with Anthony Boyle, based on the book by the great Michael McGee, and it's filming in Belfast. Can you tell us anything about that, about where that is?
Yes, of course. I was actually filming yesterday on it. We're into week 4 of filming, so we're like halfway through the shoot, and it's set in Belfast, about Sean, who is from Twinbrook in West Belfast, and he goes off to university. He's the first in his family to kind of get a degree. But then when he finishes his degree in English, in writing, he comes back and he kind of finds himself right where he started, you know, with no objective and no job and just a kind of degree and nothing to do. And so it's like a real reflection of the ceasefire babies and our generation today in like a super naturalistic, social realist kind of format, which I don't think exists yet. And I mean, yeah, the book was so beautiful. Michael McGee's writing and the way he's translated it to the screen. It's such a delicate book. And I was like, oh, how's this going to work? And then I read the scripts and was just like, you know, trying not to tear up at every other page, because it's just so real. It's so close to us. like Irish people and people that are from Belfast. And yeah, it's a privilege of my career, you know, to be part of that. So I'm really happy.
It is presumably a very, very different experience getting to play something that for yourself is so much closer to home in terms of location, in terms of age, in terms of it being set in the recent past than something like that, like A Woman of Substance. They're kind of two different beasts, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I've been lucky enough in my career so far to kind of, I have done period drama and I have done that kind of romantic side, but then I've also gone and done like Kneecap, and I did a film called The Wolf, the Fox and the Leopard about a girl raised by wolves where I'm walking on all fours. So like, I have been lucky enough to kind of explore very vastly different parts of myself in different parts and stuff, and I need that. I can't imagine. I don't know. I don't think I'm really set and like good at one thing. Maybe that's why I keep just getting dotted about the place and get to try all sorts.
Well, it's fantastic to talk to you, Jessica Reynolds. Thanks a million for joining us on Arena.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's nice to meet you.
My thanks to Jessica Reynolds, who plays the young Emma Hart in A Woman of Substance. You can watch the series on Wednesday nights on Channel 4 or All 4. Arena.
Now, if my name were Ada, I'd be Ada. Even backwards, I'd be Ada. Or if my name were Ruth, then I'd be Ruth, because with Ruth, what can you do? Or Sally, or Margaret, or Ginger, or Faye. But when you're Eliza, you always have to say, no, it's Liza with a Z, not Lisa with an S, because Lisa with an S goes snaz. It's Z instead of S, line instead of Lee. It's simple as can be, see, Liza. Oh, and that is only half of it.
It's the unmistakable sound of Liza with a Z. It's Liza Minnelli from her 1972 concert film made for television, directed by Bob Fosse and with music arranged by Kander and Ebb just a few months after the release of Cabaret. There's no doubt about it that Liza is a legend. She's the daughter of the great director Vincent Minnelli and the legend of all legends, Judy Garland. She was born into show business, Hollywood royalty, and with talent to burn. And she's one of those rare EGOT people as well, the winner of an Emmy, Golden Globe, Oscar and Tony. From the film of Cabaret in 1972, Martin Scorsese's New York, New York, to Arthur and even her recurring role in Arrested Development, she has blazed through life despite never quite escaping her mother's shadow, or indeed the shadow of a addiction. Now aged 80, she's just published her memoir, Kids, Wait Till You Hear This. And journalist Lise, with an S, Hand, has been reading it and is here to tell us if life is indeed a cabaret or not. You're very welcome, Lise.
Thank you. Great to be here.
The title is with an exclamation mark. I mean, she's lived her whole life with an exclamation mark, hasn't she?
She absolutely has. I mean, this is a book where there is literally a story on every page. And it's, I think you finished this book literally going, how the hell did she make it to 80? Because there's been so much drama. There's been, you know, mad marriages, insane love affairs. There's been huge successes. There's been massive lifelong struggle against addictions. I mean, she really has done it all. And you're just left with the feeling of, this woman is a survivor. I mean, there's a kind of indefatigability to her. Can't believe I got the word out. But to her, that's quite breathtaking. It really is.
Isn't that exactly what you want from a celebrity autobiography? All of that?
Do you know what? It really is. And, you know, there are great stories in this, but you do still get the feeling that obviously it is slightly, you know, curated. I mean, you know, basically, you know, what happened in Studio 54 stayed in Studio 54. For all the fantastic stories there, I am quite sure there were a whole heap of other stories that never made it into print, whether they were lawyered out or just for, you know, for the sake of maintaining friendships.
And sometimes that's the difference between biography and autobiography. tell me about her early life, born to Judy Garland and Vincent Minnelli at the height of her mother's fame. So what sort of upbringing did she have?
Well, it was one of those, it was sort of a, you know, an upbringing of two halves, I suppose, in a way. I mean, she had a few idyllic years as a very small child, living, you know, in splendour and going to school with other kind of showbiz kids. loving parents. She had a great relationship with her father, who doted on her. I think one very telling little anecdote of how glittery her life was he used to make her little mini versions of her favourite Hollywood costumes, and he made her a mini version of the Wicked Witch of the West for Halloween, and she went out in it, but she was afraid that nobody'd find her scary. So he, her dad rang one of their neighbours, Jean Kelly. So when Liza knocked on the door, Jean Kelly opened the door and started screaming, "Oh my God, a witch," and fell down. You know, so you have this magical sort of life. But then, of course, you have, you know, the marriage split up after just over 6 years. And her mother was struggling badly with addiction. And really from the age of six, Liza became... I think that was when Judy Garland had her first suicide attempt. And for the years after that, Liza became, as she said, sort of her carer. She was watching for, you know, signs that the darkness was setting in, and she'd be watching out for her pills. When Judy was on the road and Liza was on the road with her, she literally had to beg chemists to give her prescription pills to keep her mother going. So, you know, and then you had, of course, this extraordinary, and she goes into this at some depth, the sort of dynamic between these two women as performers. There's a great scene where they're both on stage in the London Palladium, and Judy Garland keeps on trying to hog the kind of spotlight and so on. And, you know, this is a kid who literally was pushed out on stage she made her first cameo, did her first movie cameo at the age of three. And Judy Garland was asked, did her little daughter get paid? And she said, yeah, of course she got full rights. And she said, actually, I can never forgive her just hanging around doing nothing for the first 2 years of her life. You know, so this is a girl who was born to be on stage, born to have her name in lights. They picked her name because they thought Liza Minnelli would look great in a marquee. So, you know, she was thrust into showbiz and never really ever imagined herself having any other career. Like, she literally ate, breathed it, loved showbiz from the very get-go.
Judy Garland is only 47 when she dies. Liza was 23 at the time. So what happens there then? What's the next phase of her life?
Well, I mean, as you said, Rick, you know, she spent her entire life trying to really get out from under the shadow of her mother. And, you know, she did extraordinary things. Again, this is an artiste that would try anything. You know, she did stage. She desperately wanted to be in the stage version of Cabaret, and that didn't happen for her. So when the film rights came up, she was absolutely determined to get the part of Sally Bowles. And she literally set out, she dragged along like the producer to a show, and she literally sang songs and sang to him and just wooed him into it. And she was determined to make it happen. I mean, she formed this creative partnership with John Kander and Fred Ebb, who of course wrote so many of her songs, and she literally went to their apartment and talked them into it. So you had this, you know, she built this career for herself. It was a mixture of movie and a mixture of stage, but stage was always her first love. This was always her big one. And, you know, she did acquire, she had huge successes. I mean, she won an Oscar for her part in Cabaret, and in a way that sort of role could have defined her, but then she went out of her way to try and, not particularly successfully, but try other roles and try and build, get away from the shadow of Sally Bowles, and never kind of really did. So she became this sort of plucky showgirl, really.
I want to talk about her relationships in a minute, because that's an entirely other strand.
That's an entirely different show.
But I have a clip here. This is Liza revealing to the British press that she has a new boyfriend, and this is from 1973.
My engagement to Desian the relationship has been deteriorating for some time, pleasantly, luckily, and there's no more engagement, that's all called off. And since I've been here and had this marvelous time, I also met a man called Peter Sellers and fell in love with him, and I'm very pleased to say that he fell in love with me too. All right? And that's about all I've got to say. Liza. So that I'm terribly happy.
Liza, congratulations. In fact, when did you first meet Peter Sellers?
Well, we met about 11 days ago.
Have you fixed the date for the wedding yet?
Well, no, please. What wedding is that? That's private. That's bloody private.
Liza.
That's a fine Yorkshire accent and a clip you might have seen floating around on your social media from the BBC archives this week. So her mother was married 5 times, Lise, and yes. Liza was married 4 times.
Yes.
What does she say about her relationships and her marriage in the book?
Well, she's very honest about it. I mean, she was married 4 times. 2 kind of mad marriages bookended, 2 of the more normal ones. I mean, that particular clip, at that time, she was announcing her engagement to Peter Sellers. She was also, around the same time, I think, engaged to Desi Arnaz Jr., who was the son of Lucille Ball and Desi Arnaz. And she was also married to her second husband, Jack Haley, at this time, Jack Haley Jr., who was gloriously the son of the actor who played the Tin Man in The Wizard of Oz, right? So she's massively sort of open about, you know, her marriages and the fact that she was very chaotic in them. I mean, her first husband, it was kind of fixed up by her mother, who adored him, and Peter Allen. And she found out that he was being unfaithful to her when she came home to their house one day and found him in bed with another man. And it turns out that he was a gay man. But they stayed together for several years after that, because she said they were having great fun, and even though it was a massively traumatic thing. So she talks openly about this, and they had great love for each other. So the marriage actually didn't fizzle out for a few more years after that. Then she married the Tin Man. The Tin Man's son. That didn't last too long because she was having all these chaotic affairs. She then married Mark Garrow. He was a sculptor and stage manager. And that actually lasted for, I think, about well over a decade. So, but they, again, she talked about they were more like siblings than, you know, that. And that sort of came to an end as well. And then she married David Guest. Now, before I come to him, one of the maddest stories in the book was she recounts how she was walking down her through Manhattan one day with her second husband, Jack Haley, at the same time that she was having a passionate affair with Marty Scorsese, whom she had met during the filming of New York, New York. Which also starred Bobby De Niro. She was having an affair with him. Anyway, she was walking down the street with her husband. And next thing, dancer Mikhail Baryshnikov, who she was also having an affair with, who could blame her, comes around a corner and starts screaming. No wonder I'm confused. It was actually Marty Scorsese came around the corner and started screaming at her, going, "How could you betray me?" While she was standing beside her husband. And she was also, because he was so annoyed that she was having this affair with Mikhail Baryshnikov, my head is spinning. And she sort of tells the story almost off the cuff. This was just another anecdote in the book. I mean, it was quite extraordinary. But my God, David Guest, oh my goodness. She is savage about him. And I think this book is very upbeat. So, and she's a lot of good things to say about people. And she talks about how she forms these sort of ride or die friendships with people that do endure. But then she got married and she literally is savage about him. She literally was going, you know, what in God's name was I thinking? Clearly I wasn't sober when I married this clown. And she goes on to claim that he was after her money. The marriage was over literally the day of the wedding. She knew she'd made a horrible mistake. And it ended up with massively ugly lawsuits flying left, right and centre. He sort of said that she was abusive to him. She claimed that she was only married for the money. He died in 2016, so he isn't around to rebuff any of this, of course.
Is there anybody she doesn't particularly like in here and makes it very well known?
Yeah, there's one very odd anecdote, and it's right at the very end of the book, and she talks about turning up for the 2022 Oscars, and she was co-presenting one of the awards for Best Picture with co-presenting with Lady Gaga. And she tells a story about how when she got there, they insisted that she went out on stage in a wheelchair, even though she and, interestingly enough, her doctor both said she's totally fine to go out there, sit in a chair. She had director's chairs she used to sit on because they were comfortable, but they insisted. And she then said she was below the kind of where she could see the cues and she couldn't read her notes properly because it was dark. And she came across as a bit frail, and Lady Gaga turned around and said, "I've got you," which was picked up by the mics. And Liza Minnelli said that she was massively humiliated. She said, "I thought I was betrayed." She seemed to think that Lady Gaga did did it deliberately. There's no evidence that she did, doing it out of the best of her heart, but it comes across that she was really hurt. And you could read that off as diva behaviour, but this is a woman who lived and died by being a diva, by looking fantastic, by high kicking on, you know, across sets when she was in her 60s. I mean, this woman was glamorous.
Just before we finish, you brought in a photograph yes. this evening. Can you very, very quickly explain the nature of that photograph, which we will put up on our Instagram?
Yeah, it's me standing outside the Berkeley Court Hotel chatting to Liza Minnelli. And she was in town as part of the great ultimate tour she did with Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. And I was part of the press pack that were doorstepping them, waiting to get words of wisdom from them all. Liza was so cool that she ended up hanging with us and just bumming cigarettes off us. I think Sammy gave us a few quotes. Frank made an appearance at the very end when everybody else had gone except for me, and I got thrown out of the hotel because I started running towards him. And he turned around and he said, "I think that doll's trying to say something to me." And I went, "Are you having a good time?" As he was literally been hauled out the door, and he went, "Yeah, yeah, this is a great place, great town." So I was able to just do a front page story going, "My kind of town," says Frank Sinatra. Then I rang my dad and said, "Dad, I've just been called a doll by Frank Sinatra." But like, the great thing was she was so lovely that day. She just hung out. So big star, real person.
And you are carrying one of the largest mobile phones I've ever seen in my life.
Yes.
Of the year.
Well, it was 1989.
Lisanne, thanks so much for reading the book and for joining us this evening on Arena.
Jake.
Kids, wait till I tell you this is published by Hodder and Stoughton.
You're listening to Arena Encore. You can listen to Arena every weeknight from 7 on RTE Radio 1 and the RTE Radio Player app.
The house I was reared in is but a stone on a stone. And all round the garden, the weeds they have grown, and all the kind neighbors that ever I knew.
That's the one and only voice of Dolores Cain singing May Morning Dew. There was very sad news this afternoon as her death was announced at the age of 72. She was one of the finest exponents of Irish traditional singing, began her career in the group De Donnan, but she'd been handed the gift from her two aunts, Rita and Sarah, and at their small cottage in Carlistran in Galway. It was also the album A Woman's Heart that made her utterly beloved on this island and across the world as well. To remember me over the next little while, I'm joined by people who knew her and people who worked with her over the decades. Frances Black, first of all, you're very welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rick. Very sad day.
It is. Tell me, what are your first thoughts about Dolores?
Well, I mean, I was just, devastated to hear of Dolores' passing. She was out on her own. She was an absolute legend, to be honest with you. And one of the most beautiful singers that Ireland has ever had. Authentic, the Irish authenticness, there was nothing on this earth like it. I mean, she was almost the voice of Mother Ireland. That's the way I used to think of Dolores. And honestly, it was such a privilege to be able to perform with her in the early days of The Woman's Heart. And she will be so sadly missed. My sister Mary would have been very close to her. I mean, they were on tour together with De Donnan, and I know that Mary loved Dolores and Dolores loved Mary. We all loved Dolores. I mean, who couldn't? The whole country loved Dolores. Who couldn't love her? Do you know what I mean? She was incredible.
Do you remember the first time you heard her voice?
I do. And it was actually, I was a fan of Dolores. I was a fan of Dolores and De Donnan, and it was before Mary had even joined De Donnan, if you know what I mean. And I think even before either of us ever even thought about being singer. And we had all the albums at home, and I used to sit listening to the De Donnan album with Dolores, and I sang all her songs. I'd sit singing with her, you know, Ramblin' Irishman, 18 Years Old, all of those songs I used to sing in the sing songs at home when we were at home having sessions, you know. And it was just, yeah, she was just one of the best voices in Ireland, really and truly. So sad.
We have a couple of moments like this, and I want to play something here. This is recorded in 1981. It's Derren Ní Bhriain visiting Dolores and her aunts, Rita and Sarah, in their cottage in Carlistran.
Well, I remember the sessions and the different musicians coming to the house. I remember most of that. Well, I remember Willie Clancy was here. Well, that's one thing that I do remember, actually, because I think I was a very naughty child the same night. I think true. I don't know what happened, but I think, whatever, there was a bottle of stout lying around and I had a gulp of that or something, and I got very unmannerly. And poor Willie offered me some money. You know, he put his hand in his pocket and he said, come here, girl, and have a fist of money, you know? And I said, oh, I don't want your old money. You know? And I think of that to this day, how horrible I was to Willie Clancy.
Well, use people like Willie, I mean, people from other parts of the country, they'd travel down to come here for a session some night, would they?
Yeah, I mean, that mostly we'd say from Flacules or something like that. If Sarah or Rita met people at Flacules, they'd say, well, we'll have to go down to the house and have a session sometime. And then maybe a few weeks later, they'd arrive in. But not maybe just the two that you invited, about maybe four or five more, you know, yes. Which made it all the merrier.
That's recorded for a documentary in 1981. Frances, maybe if you can, talk to me a little bit about that idea of, because she was this extraordinary voice that was almost this connection to an older and to an ancient Ireland. But by the time you started working with her, or certainly by the time A Woman's Heart came around in 1992, that was a very modern album.
Yeah, it was. I mean, you know, it was an album that where there was tracks taken off all our own albums and just played. It was a kind of a compilation album. You know, like Dolores had tracks taken off one of her albums, Caledonia, and I think the other one was, I can't remember the other song on The Woman's Heart that Dolores had. But I know that they were taken off. And then obviously Mary and Eleanor went into the studio and recorded the song A Woman's Heart. And I don't think any of us in our wildest dreams could have ever dreamed of the success of that album. But the best part of it all was when we went on tour. And there was myself in the early days, there was myself and Sharon and Dolores and Eleanor and Maura O'Connell. And oh my God, it was one of the most memorable times. And we had such good fun, the laughs we had, the excitement. And of course, for me, the privilege of being on the road with Dolores Keane, somebody who was a fan from, you know, very young age. I mean, she's not that much older than me, but like I would have been a teenager. Dolores would have been, you know, maybe in her early 20s, but she'd already recorded albums. But to be able to sing on stage with Dolores Keane, and I used to always stand side stage watching Dolores. And what was amazing was the connection with the audience. When Dolores walked out on stage, the audience would clap 5 minutes before she'd even open her mouth. She was adored, loved to this day. I mean, you can see the way everybody is just, you know, on social media and so online, people are just devastated to hear of her passing, you know. So, like, she really was iconic. She was a legend. And there was no one on this earth like her. And there will never be anybody like her. You know what I mean? Her voice was just so pure and from the soul, and it touched everybody's hearts and minds and souls. And yeah, she was out on her own.
Given that you had loved her and loved her work and then toured with her, what do you think you learned from her as a singer?
I think to be authentic, to always be yourself on stage, just go out there and sing from the heart. And I think that's really what, you know, definitely. And when you hear her albums, when you listen to Dolores, when you heard her there, you know, singing The May Morning Dew, it just releases some kind of endorphin in your brain that's just beyond any explanation, you know. There's just no one like her. But I think for me, it was just to be yourself, to be on, you know, be yourself on stage. Don't worry if you make a mistake, you know, just do whatever you have to do, have a laugh about it. Like, there was never, you know, and that was the way Dolores did it. If she went out on stage and if she made a mistake, she'd have a laugh and then she'd start again. The crowd would go mad. You know, it was just, everybody learned from Dolores.
That made me think about where I come from. That's the reason why I seem so far away today. Let me tell you that I love you, that I think Caledonia, you're calling me. Now I
Caledonia. That's Dolores Cain, who passed away today at the age of 72. We're joined by Paul Brady. Paul, how are you?
How are you doing, Rick? Yeah, very sad to hear this news.
Tell me about your history with Dolores.
Well, I first became aware of Dolores, of course, when she came into Dedannan, and songs like the Rambling Irishman were just blew me away totally. I mean, the woman's voice, I mean, if any one voice could express a whole race of people or a country purely, it was Dolores's. You know, it was an extraordinary voice, beautiful. And I was very privileged to work with her from time to time.
Talk to me about that process, about what she was like to work with as well as just listen to.
Well, I'd have to say that, I mean, when she recorded my song, The Island, in the mid-80s, it was a year and a half or so after my version came out, which kind of sneaked out. It was actually Dolores' version of the song, her beautiful version, which drew attention to The Island much more so than my version, and made it the popular song that it is today. So I was always honoured and grateful for her having decided to record the song. And, I'm just wrecked here at the moment with sorrow at her loss, yeah.
But, Paul, what was it you thought that she brought to that interpretation?
Well, for a start, she loved a melody, always. And any song she sang always had a pretty strong melody. And she went for the melody in that song just in the way I heard it in my head. And she just, her expression of the melody was beautiful. But also, her, just the way she sang the words, it just lifted the song onto a different place, and made it much more accessible to people. And it was an extraordinary combination of her voice and the song,
It's a fairly extraordinary thing to do as a performer, Paul, isn't it? That idea of accessibility and people, because she was loved as a live performer as well.
Well, yes. I mean, she just has a natural voice that she just, no matter what comes out of her mouth, it was just beautiful. And I mean, she liked to perform too, and she had a long career in various different shapes. But at the back of it all was this fierce strength of her background in music and her aunts and all that, and the Irish music of the West of Ireland and traditional music. And she was the queen of singers,
How good a singer was she, Paul? Where would you put her?
She was the best, She was there's nobody better than Dolores Cain when she was in her prime and in her full voice. It was a voice that would just, knock you dead. It was just beautiful.
Paul Brady, thanks so many for taking the time out tonight.
Oh, not at all. It's a sad night.
You're listening to Arena.
That's it for this week's Arena Encore. You can listen to Arena live on RTE Radio 1 every weekday evening from 7. And you can listen back via the RTE Radio Player, rte.ie, or wherever you get your podcasts.